Welcome to the Engaged Midwife Podcast. This is Missy.
And this is Kara.
Hi, Kara.
Hi, Missy.
You guys just did such an amazing podcast episode. It's going to be hard to follow.
It was so much fun chatting with my sister and letting her shine in her moment. So that was cool.
It's going to be amazing. I love it. Well, today I want to talk about something that is super common and like 90% of the time is really straightforward. It's the 10% of the time that it is problematic, and that's vaginitis.
Yeah. I mean, I remember, you know, my current practice is really straight OB. And so you occasionally still have vaginitis in pregnancy, obviously. But when my practice was more GYN, I felt like I spent day after day talking to women about their vaginas and treating vaginitis.
I mean, it's kind of our favorite thing.
Yeah. I mean, I like them when they're healthy, vaginas particularly. But yeah, a good challenge every so often is I'm up for it.
Right. And I think you and I have some experience that might be helpful for people when they see more complex vaginitis. But let's start with some of the basics and maybe what the CDC says about just common vaginitis and common, you know what I mean by common, but like the more straightforward kinds of vaginitis. But let's first start with vaginal discharge, because I do a lot of saying, like, if it doesn't itch, burn, or smell bad, it's probably just physiologic discharge.
Right, right. And, you know, people have varying amounts of normal discharge for themselves, and it can increase and decrease in any cycle. But some people just have more discharge than others. And I like to think of it as, you know, a self-cleaning organ. That's what I say. You hear other people say that too, but maybe it's just their body's way of clearing things out, and it's okay. It's not necessarily a bad thing.
Yeah. Self-cleaning oven. It's something I say all the time. People laugh at me and I think, no, like you don't have to put anything in there to clean it. So The whole, you know, campaign in the 50s and 60s of like every woman needs to douche. All we do when we put foreign substances, douche, whatever, into our vaginas is all we do is wash out all the normal flora that we know is good for the vagina.
Right. Because there's a normal ecosystem typically, and there's a little bit of different types of bacteria. There's typically a little bit of yeast, but it's got a nice, healthy little ecosystem going on. And when you add products or cleaning agents or different things, you're disrupting that normal ecosystem, and then things can go awry.
Right. So that's, I guess, the first point of this in the bullet points of podcast notes is vaginas have normal flora and you don't want to wash them out. And if they have physiologic discharge that doesn't itch, burn, or smell bad, that's okay in varying quantities.
Well, and I kind of have a little spiel that I go through all the time about like Kara's instructions for caring for your vagina and vulva. And it really is like, don't use harsh soaps. Like it cleans itself. You can use water, maybe some like baby soap or Ivory, something really, really basic. You know, you don't necessarily need to shave everything bare. There's a reason there's hair there. You know, wipe from front to back. Thong underwear acts like floss. It moves bacteria into places we don't necessarily want it. And then kind of your idea of if it doesn't itch or smell bad, you know, that kind of thing, it's not bad. Same idea of like, if you're using products that taste good, smell good, or tingle, they're probably not good for your tissue because they're doing something, they're adding some sort of product that's disrupting that ecosystem.
Did you find when you were a new grad or a less seasoned midwife that these were harder conversations to have? I think we have established definitely a spiel of things that we say now that we've been in practice for a really long time.
Well, and I'll be vulnerable. Like, I think I'm more comfortable with my own vaginas. So I'm more comfortable talking about vaginas in general. Talking about my own, talking about others, you know, I try to tell people all the time that it's just another body part. It's like a big toe. Like, I don't think of it as anything. Now, my own vagina, I think it's a big deal. Like, I don't want to show it to other people, but when I'm trying to explain to people, it's really just another body part. I do get that it's very personal for people, but yeah, we should normalize the conversations around caring for it, recognizing when something's awry, those kinds of things.
And something's not right. Yeah. Right. So, I mean, you and I have done a really nice podcast episode on kind of what the CDC treatment update was in 2021 for STIs, but also the CDC talks about how do we treat things like yeast and BV and the what I would consider non-sexually transmitted vaginal infections.
Right.
And go ahead.
They're sexually associated. I mean, in the fact that most of the time people that are not sexually active won't have BV and yeast and so forth. And so that's why they're included. And also the symptoms kind of overlap with other types of infections, but you're right. They're not really infections. They're just, a disruption of the normal ecosystem, a little bit of a throwing off of the pH and so forth.
Do you think we need to go through diagnostic kinds of things, or can we go straight to how do we treat those? Because general, we see, wet preps, et cetera, or Affirm tests. Everybody's got like a different test that they do. So I think the diagnostic things are pretty straightforward.
Right. Right. I think we could talk about, if you don't know those, pause the podcast, go take a quick look at your AMSLS criteria for vaginitis, think about the pH and the microscopy and KOH. But I do think let's talk about straightforward treatment. And then as you mentioned, I think the most interesting part is when things are a little bit more challenging.
Awesome. So I want to give at least something that I have learned empirically through the years about treating vaginitis. And that is, things that you put in your vagina tend to work better and faster than things you put in your mouth. And this goes back to pharmacology, where we talk about first pass metabolism. And I talk about this with birth control too. Yes. Any medication that you put in your mouth has to be absorbed and go through your liver and undergoes first pass metabolism. So a certain amount of that drug is being then metabolized, and it's not bioavailable for treatment of whatever you're trying to treat. So when you take birth control pills, right, it has to go through your liver for first pass metabolism. When you take a pill for BV or yeast, I know it's easier and it's not messy, but you don't get the bioavailability of the drug to where it needs to be as quickly or as efficiently.
Right. If you take something orally, it's treating all tissues in your body, rather than treating the tissues locally where the inflammation, infection, pH is off. So,
yes. So as we start these conversations, I will always lean towards things that go in your vagina.
Me too.
Okay, cool. I'm glad we're on the same page.
Yeah.
So Kara, do you want to talk some about what we do to treat yeast?
So for yeast, typically, you can go with an over-the-counter treatment regimens typically work just fine. Any of the azole creams. Now, I am a huge fan of the 7-night treatments. I think that the 1 applicator administration and even the 3 can almost cause another type of like contact dermatitis inflammation because they're so strong. And so the creams that are more like 7 nights, I tend to go towards because it's longer treatment. It isn't as caustic to the tissues and tends to work really, really well.
I agree with that.
And I usually tell people just buy the cheap store brand. There's no reason to get fancy with these things. And the nice thing as well is that cream works locally, like on the vulva too. Cause sometimes, it's not just vaginal, but some of it, obviously, as you mentioned, is kind of messy. Some of it gets on the vulva and it helps with that external itching that so many people have. When I do prescribe an oral like Diflucan for yeast, I end up almost always giving them a cream as well to use externally because it's going to take a couple of days for the oral medication to really take its full effect. And so it's nice to use the creams.
Also, I want to be really clear that when you give Diflucan, which people will come in and request, it has a very poor first dose cure rate. So if you give somebody one dose of Diflucan, the likelihood that it's going to completely resolve their yeast is like under 40%. It's a very low first time cure rate. Mm-hmm. So if you're going to give Diflucan, oftentimes you have to give it and have the patient repeat it in 72 hours or repeat it in a week. And then you get a higher cure rate and rather than that one time dosing.
You're right. I always, when I write for Diflucan, give one refill there are times, particularly in a more complex case, where I may prescribe every 72 hours for two or three doses for exactly the reason that you talked about.
Yeah. So, you have a lot of flexibility, I feel like, with how you treat yeast. And if somebody calls and thinks they have yeast, an over-the-counter treatment, I think is an awesome option because they just go to the pharmacy. They don't have to have anything. They just buy an over-the-counter treatment. And in most cases with very straightforward yeast infections, you get good resolution.
Yeah, absolutely.
Do you want to talk a little about BV?
Sure. So BV, I find to be more common even than yeast. The treatments for it, I just like you, I'm a big fan of the gel. So like metronidazole gel for 5 nights. And the option, there is an oral option to do flagellar metronidazole orally. You do have to give precautions about the disulfiram-like reaction. So you can't have alcohol with the oral administration. And then there is an option that you can do like a clindamycin cream, but I don't find it as helpful. I really tend to stick more with the metronidazole, either the cream or the oral.
Yeah. And interestingly enough, flagyl, if you give it PO, does have a pretty good cure rate. It's better than what you would get with something like Diflucan because you're giving a longer course.
Agreed. And metronidazole is a good agent. Like it just generally tends to work really well. I have found that literally I'll tell patients like we can do it orally, but you can't have any alcohol or you can do it this way. And they're like, oh, I'll give me the cream, so it really depends on what your plans are, what's coming up and that kind of thing on limitations. But you're right. I mean, it does work well. I still really like a cream vaginally. But
I really like a cream vaginally too. So that's, yeah. That's that. Other kinds of vaginitis things that do we see that really can be problematic in the office?
Well, the other one that I almost always think about is, BV yeast and then trich, with trich being a little bit less frequent. It may depend on the population that you're serving, how much you see this. Because I have certainly in some of my safety net clinics, more public health service kind of clinics, seen more trich than I have in other settings, but it really may just depend on the prevalence in your area. But the interesting thing with trich is that the treatment recommendations from the CDC differ between how we treat women with a vaginitis versus how you treat a man that may have a trich infection. And this is one is obviously that not just vagina havers get trich. And so we also have to remember to treat partners with trich. So that makes it a little bit different. We don't typically treat partners with yeast or BV. I've seen that sometimes in a more complicated case, but it is not standard to treat partners whenever you have a patient with BV or yeast. So interestingly, the recommendation for women is oral flagyl, oral metronidazole, twice a day for 7 days. And then for men, it's actually the one time metronidazole 2 grams. So a little bit different. You get better concentration in the tissues with the twice a day over 7 days versus in men, you don't need that same tissue saturation and so forth. And so the 2 gram one time dose is fine. It's kind of interesting that they differ.
Yeah, it is interesting. And it's really important, I think, in cases with trich, just like with if we were treating chlamydia or we're treating gonorrhea, that we think about partner treatment. I also missed my opportunity to say something about BV that is important. And because I see this a lot in clinical practice, which is if you're using any kind of toys or things that go in the vagina and you've had an issue with BV, it's really just important that you understand how you're cleaning your toys and how often you're cleaning them and what you're cleaning them with, because they can be a source of infection.
I think that's just a good general, I mean, yes, for BV, certainly, but just across the board is good to know how to care for toys and take care of them and prevent infection. So good point.
Yeah. So, okay. We both know you can like, hey, my patient's got BV yeast trick, something that's going on. We can go to the CDC. We can pick any one of the whole, I mean, there are so many treatment regimens that are appropriate, but let's talk about some more complex things. Let's talk about atrophic vaginitis, because I think it's something that we see in women of a certain age. I might be a woman of a certain age. And it that can be bothersome and also be misdiagnosed.
Yeah, it's not unusual that I've had a patient that comes in and they're like, I've been treated like 3 times for yeast and it's not getting any better. And I still have all this burning and itching and I'm just so uncomfortable. And I do a wet prep and there's no yeast anywhere. And I flip through the chart to see, did anybody do like a vaginal culture or a yeast culture? And I can't see anywhere that they've like actually had like the full, and I'm like, I think this is more atrophic vaginitis. Like you're in your 40s or you're breastfeeding, for the past 8 months and, you know, there's just not enough estrogen in the tissues, and that can really cause some serious irritation and itching and burning that acts a lot like yeast, or sometimes even has discharge and acts more like BV, but you don't see anything on your wet prep or your culture comes back with nothing. And you're like, what the heck? What, you know, why is she so uncomfortable? And sometimes I will do a trial of some estrogen cream to see if that will help. And oftentimes it makes a huge difference.
Yeah. It's also part of the like clinical presentation, right? If you do a speculum exam and you look at the vaginal walls, like what do they look like? They should look flush and like they have good, you know, soft tissue in the vagina.
Pink and a lot rugated and all of those. Yes. I love the word flush, by the way. Great word.
Thanks. I've been working on my adjectives to describe vaginas because I've been doing some teaching recently and I'm like, I need better words, but plush is one of them. But when you're looking, does it look thin? Does it look red? Does it look like tissue paper, right? Does it look painful? And honestly, these are some women who can also come in with a complaint of dyspareunia. And when they come in, they are like, oh, it hurts when I have intercourse. It hurts when I do, you know, this activity or that activity. And that makes a ton of sense. It might not have anything to do with infection, and it might not have anything to do with like actually something that they're having some sort of sexual dysfunction. It just has everything to do with what's going on in their vaginal walls.
Well, and I remember being postpartum and breastfeeding and thinking to myself that I was constantly aware that I had a vagina, and that wasn't something I'd ever been thinking about before. Like, you know, every time you went to the bathroom and wiped, or every time you sat down or something like that. And I explained that a few years ago to a student that like, we shouldn't be thinking that we have, like, we should just know that we have one. It doesn't cross our mind. And she had used that same kind of terminology then with a perimenopausal woman. And the woman was like, you are so right. I shouldn't be thinking about my vagina. So I think it overlaps a lot.
So talk about treatment.
Well, so big fan of estrogen cream. It works locally on the tissue. A little bit goes a long way. I know that, you know, depending on if you're using, is it estrace cream or Premarin cream, it comes with an applicator. I tell people to get rid of the applicator and just use a little bit on their fingertip, insert the finger a little bit in the vagina, and then also on that external vulvar tissues. And you can get pretty good improvement. They will feel better within a couple of weeks. The tissues, they may have less urinary incontinence as well, if that's a problem, because it just helps make those tissues more flush or plump. I like plump too. And that it just brings back life and vitality to that atrophic vagina and vulva. And it's really, it can be quite helpful.
A caveat to this thing though, with estrogen cream, is it can be really expensive.
It can be very, very expensive.
Yeah. I mean, and even for like a tube of it, it can be upwards of $300 depending on what insurance looks like. So just be really aware when you're looking at this, because it is the best treatment. And if patients need any kind of prior auth, or they need some, you know, evidence that their insurance should pay for it, et cetera, like this is the treatment for atrophic vaginitis that works. Yeah.
I've also used like NuvaRing before for someone that also needed contraception. You could do a low dose pill as well. The thing I like about NuvaRing is that people oftentimes complain with it that they have more discharge. And right. If we have a dry vagina, a little bit extra discharge wouldn't be a bad thing. And so I do like that it also works locally.
I say that too. I'm like, you have extra discharge. Fantastic. That's what that's meant to do. Again, yeah. NuvaRing, good example of no first pass metabolism, right? It's like working in the vagina where it's supposed to work. I also liked that you said that you tell them to get rid of the applicator, because it is a little bit, goes a long way when you're thinking about estrogen cream. You don't need a lot to do what it's supposed to do because of first pass metabolism. There is no first pass metabolism.
And then they won't be so upset about messiness, that sort of thing. I did once have a patient ask me if her husband was going to have any effect with her using vaginal cream. And we laughed a lot and said, no, like it's not going to have that big of an effect. It absorbs and it shouldn't cause any issue for the partner.
So I love that conversation. I think we don't talk enough about menopause. I think menopause is so brings just such a varied group of symptoms and things that are hard to treat. And that's a topic for another podcast. I have an amazing guest in mind to talk about how we treat menopause and how we treat women that are in that phase of life. So,
yeah.
Do you want to talk? Let's talk a little bit more about what happens when we treat our patient for BV or yeast and it doesn't work.
Yeah, I'm really curious because I know that you wanted to hit on some of the more complex or challenging cases. And I'm going to guess that you have some good ideas that come up when you have patients with those types of situations.
So there's a couple of like situations that I think are really interesting that have come up in clinical practice and that I have found to be really challenging. But the first thing is like, what kind of testing can we do outside of like our traditional wet prep or Affirm, right? Like if those tests come back negative and your patient clearly still is having symptoms, then what, right? I think depending on where you work, GenPath like is a test. It's a vaginal culture, right? You just take a culture with like the same kind of like what you would do with a GBS swab and you run that, and it runs a battery of tests for about 10 to 15 different kinds of organisms that may be like atypical organisms. I wanted to say orgasm, but that's another conversation, in the vagina, right? And so GenPath is a great next step when we're trying to like figure out what's going on in somebody's vagina. Yeah, but also absolutely. An easy test is just GBS, because we do GBS testing in pregnancy. And for almost every pregnant person, GBS is like a totally asymptomatic thing, because so many women, that's just part of their normal flora, right?
It's just a colonization. It doesn't cause an infection. Yeah.
However, GBS can cause symptoms in non-pregnant people. And so that's an easy test to do, right? You have that in your drawer always. And so that's sometimes a nice place to start. But I think a GenPath is another great example of maybe we can really get down to what it is that is bothering someone. So
agreed. Because I've heard, you know, over the years with more challenging cases, some physicians really looking at like mycoplasma or ureaplasma and some of those different bugs that cause a little bit different symptoms.
Yeah. And And so that's just a step, right? It can, right, again, be an expensive test. So I don't use it unless I need to use it. But it's an idea that, you know, hey, let's see what we can get to in this next, you know, phase of testing.
You can also culture for different types of yeast, but you have to make sure that you're asking for that, because, you know, while Candida is the most common, the Candida albicans is the most common that we see, there can be some resistant strains, and you can throw all the azoles and the diflucan at it and it's not going to do the right thing. So you can do that if you have a challenging yeast case.
Yeah. So the other piece of it is that, like, what is happening in the vagina that's causing colonization, right? It generally has to do with some sort of change in the pH or some sort of irritant that has gone into the vagina. You talked about things that taste good and tingle, like that kind of stuff, right? Yeah. But what the other things that change pH, and we've talked about some of these, that's douching. Tampon use can also change the pH of the vagina. Mm-hmm. Things that we've talked about that are just like normal physiologic things are like pregnancy, menopause, menarche. So one of the most interesting cases of vaginitis that I have seen was in a newly menstruating teenager who was not sexually active, who just had this longstanding vaginal irritation that took a really long time to get to the bottom of. Wasn't using tampons, wasn't doing anything to her vagina, but just the change in hormones from being prepubescent to being menstruating caused this constant sort of irritation in her vagina that I tried so many things for. I actually think I should probably write it up as a case report because it's so fascinating. But also new partner, right?
Yeah.
Also introducing something new into the vagina. So thinking about what changes vaginal pH is important. But the one treatment that I have gone towards with complicated cases of vaginitis is boric acid. So I really like a boric acid suppository, like it, you know, goes vaginal again into the vagina, right? Because it works the best there. Mm-hmm. And also it has a really good cure rate after about a month. I mean, if you use it for a month, it's up to about a 70% cure rate for these like atypical kinds of vaginitis.
That sounds nice. I mean, I think that people don't always automatically go there, but I think for someone that you have that has either recurrence or just seems more complicated, that's a great option.
Yeah. And it's the dose for boric acid, by the way, is 600 milligrams of boric acid. It goes into the vagina. It's daily for a month. Actually, I was just reading some recent research that says that it can be up to 88%. Cure rate after a month, which is awesome. Wow. If they use the treatment for 12 weeks, it's like 92%. So boric acid is like an easy, like high yield, high cure rate opportunity for like doing something different in the vagina.
I'm going to guess that it's probably not very expensive either.
It's not very expensive. A couple of things, like you can get it as an over-the-counter preparation. It just like you can go on Amazon, order boric acid capsule or compounding pharmacy, depending like on how, like where you live and what's available. But yeah, it's just not a very expensive treatment.
That's awesome. You know, as you were talking about some of the different tests that we could do to think of, or, you know, the workup and that sort of thing, I don't want to forget that I also, particularly with recurrent yeast, think about those things that cause immune compromise or like increased sugar levels, because yeast likes to eat up its sugars and so forth. And so I oftentimes will do a hemoglobin A1C and or an HIV test, just thinking about some of those things that are a little bit less common but might cause immune compromise or frequent yeast infections.
The diabetes thing, right?
Right.
Like, that's a huge deal. Like, if your hemoglobin A1C is 7 and you have recurrent vaginal infection, it's because yeast loves all that sugar.
Well, and I've had known diabetic patients that are infrequently with yeast, and no one has helped them to understand that if your sugar levels are high in your blood, they are also high in your vagina. And if we get better control of your glucose and your diabetes, you are going to have less yeast infections. And once someone explains that to them, it's like you almost literally see the light bulb go off over their head. And it also gives them another reason that they should want to control their blood sugars a little bit more, because an uncomfortable vagina makes your life uncomfortable. You shouldn't be thinking about it all the time, right?
You should not be acutely aware that you have a vagina every day.
Right.
I mean, that's not a very feminist perspective, but I'm just saying, like, it's not,
I mean,
like,
I'm ecstatic that I have one. I just don't want to think about it all the time.
Well, it's like, also, if you thought every day about how your heart and lungs worked, and like, I have a heart and lungs and they, you know, oxygenate me and provide me blood flow, it's the same thing. Like, you don't think about that every day. You shouldn't think about your vagina every day.
Right. Right.
So, well, I think that the biggest things, I think the takeaways for this are, like, do you have a standard thing where you're like, oh, if my patient comes in with this, this, and this, this is what I standardly say to people. Like, this is what I would like for you to do. So I think that's the first thing for people who are having trouble, you know, with vaginitis or recurrent vaginitis or people with comorbidities in the office. Like, what is your standard spiel? And you and I have done a good job of like sharing some of the things that we say. The other thing is, like, do you have your favorites? It's sort of like when you're prescribing birth control, right? I have my favorites that I'm always going to talk about, but some of those aren't good options for people. So then we have to go the another direction. And then do you understand what the next line is? If your standard things, like your standard testing, your Affirm and your wet prep don't show you what you think they're going to show you. And then how do you move to another step? And I think those are the most important things in terms of nurse practitioners and midwives, because if things are refractory to you doing a gen path and maybe using something like boric acid or Premarin cream or, you know, something beyond our standard vaginitis treatments, that's probably a great opportunity for referral. And that is definitely a standard that you and I have always talked about. Like, when does it become something that we refer for?
Yeah. Yeah, agreed. I think you're right on track with the takeaways. The only other thing that I would add is that these are perfect examples that I think of, like, going back to the very basics about what is the chief complaint. As soon as I know what the chief complaint is, I already have a differential diagnosis list in my head of what the common causes of that chief complaint are. And then I'm going to go in and I'm going to get my HPI and I'm going to take a really good history. And probably before I step out of the room to have the patient change clothes, I'm going to have an idea of what my diagnosis is, because I've marked things off my differential list or I've added new things in. And then my workup, my evaluation, my physical exam is really just going to help me confirm that. And I'm a big believer in not treating vaginitis just by complaints, because there are so many times that once I've done my wet prep or once I've done a really thorough history, it's gone in a different direction than what I initially thought. And so I'm a big believer at looking at the tissues, doing a wet prep or some other sort of test, and really targeting treatment on that. Because so often what's uncomfortable to someone may not actually be an infection. They may just have more, you know, physiologic discharge. And so we can talk through ideas about that as well. But I don't want to treat something that's not there.
Well, and that's a great point when we're talking about phone triage, right? There are things that when people call in, I'll be like, I want to try this thing. And if it doesn't work, I want to see you in the office.
Yes.
But vaginitis is not generally one of them, unless it's somebody that I know who's had recurrent yeast and I know I can call something in. It's just something that I really want to see what the vaginal mucosa looks like. And I really want to understand, like, what is happening so that I treat with the right thing. Could you potentially harm somebody by treating them for BV when it was yeast? I mean, there's always theoretical, right, harm, but it's better to actually see those patients. I mean, also, that's like the idea, like, do you treat mastitis over the phone, right? Or do you really want to see what that looks like? Is it mastitis versus, you know, are they having some sort of breakdown of their nipple and they're having pain? Like, I think this is a whole conversation about phone triage, actually a whole episode on triage in general that I think, you know, could be beneficial to our listeners. So
But great. Let's mark that one and revisit it, because I have lots of ideas about what we treat over the phone versus what needs a visit. And I think that's a great point.
Also, I think it might be fun to bring in some of our friends who work in like OB triage, like in the hospital, because, you know, that's a role too that a lot of midwives aren't familiar with. They do, the nurses do a lot of triage and then call the providers. But there are places like where I work at Vandy where we actually have midwives that run our OB triage. So I think put it down as a coming soon episode.
Sounds good. Well, I really appreciate this conversation. It's nice to revisit, even as a really seasoned provider that has dealt with a lot of vaginitis over my career, and coming up with differentials and the workup and the treatment plans. And so it was really nice to revisit this topic, and I hope it's really helpful to students and new grads and new providers.
Yeah, I love this. You know, we'll just keep going down the list of things that people have been asking us to talk about, and hopefully giving you some good tips and tricks for your own practice. So thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, take care, everyone.